Both tactics would allow you to put your brand right in front of people's eyes in a fun, interactive, unobtrusive way. Snapchat 201. Collaborate. There is no discoverability on Snapchat. People have to know who you are and be motivated to come find you and follow you. That makes organizing collaborations tricky unless you reach out to people on their other platforms, their email, their Instagram, whatever, and either suggest doing something special together on Snapchat or offer something of value in return for a shout out or an endorsement on their channel. If you need other influencers to help you grow your account, you're probably not big enough to be much of an interest to them unless you've got something pretty spectacular up your sleeve. Here are some ideas for growing your followers to build your brand and make yourself more attractive for collabs. A. Write multiple blog posts about Snapchat, so when the media needs a quote about it, they'll come to you. B. Gain visibility by creating Snapchat events, such as Giraffe Snap Park project that helped launch the career of Sean Doris. We'll talk about that later. C. Pay for a Google ad that asks something like, who should I follow on Snapchat? And offer a list of names with yours at the top. One more suggestion. You could visit the 11thsecond.com, a website founded by Serene Q, Snapchat artist and influencer extraordinaire. She created the website in response to the app's lack of discovery. There, you can submit and check out Snapchatter descriptions and usernames to make it easier for users to find accounts that match your interests. Like Meow Chickenfish, who uses Snapchat art to teach sign language, and Snapchat Chef, who makes cooking videos. The site is a screenshot repository for cool Snapchat art, as well as a resource where Snapchatters can look for tips, hacks, inspirations, advice, and more. Serene Q saw a problem. No discovery option on her favorite platform, and solved it. Like all good entrepreneurs, she found a way. Imagine this. Let's say you're like me, a 42-year-old influencer who has become somewhat pigeonholed in terms of the kind of content that is expected from you. You already have a blog, a Q&A show, a daily vlog. While playing around on Snapchat, you realize it could provide you an interesting outlet where you could create a new narrative, a place to microvlog. It's a place where you can talk about your coffee, show a picture of the colorful cereal aisle in your supermarket, and reveal that your favorite color marker is green. It's where Rick, the clothing store manager, snaps himself playing wiffle ball with friends, and where Sally, the real estate agent, admits that even though she's paleo, she has a weakness for fried pies. Sharing these minor, seemingly unimportant details, often embellished with the colorful doodles or fun filters, will do nothing whatsoever to help build any of your brands as influencers in our respective fields, but gives our followers a chance to see us as the humans we are.
How I'm crushing it. Sean McBride, Sean Doris. Instagram, at Sean Doris. It's no secret that I think spending 4 years getting a college degree, if you have your heart set on becoming a business person or entrepreneur, is a waste of time and money. Make that a fucking waste of time and money. I feel that strongly about it. However, I am grateful to Weber State University in Utah, because that's where Sean McBride received Crush It as a reading assignment from one of its professors in 2010. If he hadn't, it might have been a few more years before we finally heard of him. The timing, however, put Sean in a position to become a mega influencer. And he did it on a platform where most people said it couldn't be done. Sean embodies the work hard, work smart model. At the time that he was getting his degree, Sean was also running a skate snowboard shop. It made sense. Until then, skateboarding had been the main joy in his life. His other love was motivating people and sharing positively. He'd spent 2 years on a service mission in Honduras. That's how he got his nickname, Sean Doris, where he had been moved by his experience serving others and helping make a difference in their lives. The skate shop was an ideal place for him to share his love of sport and service. Problem was, while he liked the work, it wasn't always much fun. He knew he wanted to build a business, and he knew his passion was skateboarding, but he had a suspicion that building a business around that passion could be a great way to ensure that he rarely got to indulge in it, like the music teacher and his neglected symphony in Mr. Holland's Opus. You can kill your passions. On a very good snow day, I was in the shop because everyone needed to buy gear to go snowboarding. I think it's often best to chase things that are in line with your passions but aren't exactly your passion. Upon reading Crush It!, he applied some of what he learned in his in-store customer service, but more significant, the book made him realize that if he went about it creatively, he might be able to build an e-commerce business that would allow him to have fun every day doing something he loved. He didn't know anything about e-commerce, but he figured the best way to learn was to just go for it. What could he sell online that would also allow him to interact regularly with people? His first thought, of course, was skateboards and snowboards. But snowboards need a lot of storage and are costly to ship and hard to buy in bulk. They were his passion, but they were not a practical choice. So what was small, lightweight, and easy to buy in bulk? Jewelry. Who bought jewelry? Moms. And where were moms hanging out? Facebook. At the time, Facebook was still in the early stages of its gargantuan growth, adding millions of users every month, women leading the way to make up 57% of the site membership and accounting for 62% of the shares. And Facebook had all these features that could enhance engagement. For example, if one person commented on a post, all their friends could see it. It's hard to remember, but at the time, that was still pretty remarkable. Facebook became Sean's storefront and his design studio. I would ask my fans to tell me what kind of styles they wanted and help me name the pieces. I do giveaways like, whoever picks the best name for this necklace will get 10 free necklaces. Engagement went through the roof. He gave people every opportunity to interact with the site. It felt like they were part of the jewelry boutique and that we were creating it together. No one was more surprised by the venture's success than Sean. I didn't even think it was going to work. I was hoping I could make $50 a week extra by shipping a couple necklaces out of the back of my skate shop. And within 1 week, I had more orders than I could handle. Within 2 weeks, I'd hired all my sisters and I was paying them with necklaces. It took only 2 months to net six figures. He quickly hired more help, and by the end of the first year, the business had made $1.2 million. But Sean wasn't there to celebrate. He was having a blast, but after about 8 months, he was done. His excitement for the business was rooted in the steep learning curve. Now that he'd learned everything he needed to know, he was ready to see if he could apply that knowledge to a new business, one that traded in helping brands tell stories and spread positive messages via social media rather than selling consumer goods. Sean sold the business to his partner and quit his day job at the retail shop, but instead of immediately starting a new company, he accepted a dream job as a sales rep for some of his favorite skateboard and snowboard brands, a position that gave him plenty of opportunity to shred as much as he liked. It also bought him the time he needed to study the market and figure out a scalable long-term business idea. The job required that he travel a lot, so Sean's high school-age sisters asked him to download a new app popular among teens called Snapchat to make it easier for him to share his adventures with them. There it was. The answer he'd been seeking. At the time, you had to hold your finger on the screen or the image would disappear. That meant 100% engagement. You could draw cartoons and doodles on your pictures with your finger, something you couldn't do on any other platform. That meant fun. If there's one thing Sean had learned from his jewelry boutique experiment, it's that he was good at creating safe online communities where people could come together to engage and have fun. The greatest challenge was trying to grow on a platform that did not cater to growth. Snapchat was a communication platform like text messaging, so I had to make it into a content creating platform. Eventually, Snapchat made updates, which helped with that, but I had to get creative at first. There's a reason Sean's content got so much attention when so many others on Snapchat did not. He treated Snapchat like a business. Many people start pumping out cool content onto a platform and just hope they'll get noticed and grow their audience enough that brands will come calling. Usually you have to be more proactive than that. Sean had a plan. He set himself a series of goals, and everything he did from that moment was in service of meeting them. Goal number one was to grow an audience through creative engagement and collaborations, so he started doodling. Every day he would post a video of himself doing something goofy, or a fun picture he'd doctored to make people laugh, like a unicorn vomiting rainbows over a snowy landscape, or his dachshunds in silly costumes and poses. He also invited his fans to participate in his snaps. For example, he drew himself as a triceratops and announced that he wanted help building Giraffe Snap Park, posting requests for friends to take selfies, drawing themselves as dinosaurs, and send the pictures to him. He took screenshots of the images and displayed them. The response was tremendous. It felt like one-to-one communication. On a lot of social media, you make a beautiful image and then people comment below. Snapchat felt more collaborative. We built the stories up together. Most people would naturally assume that it was Sean's artistic abilities that drew him to the platform, but there's something funny about the way he drew his way to Snapchat stardom. I literally did not know how to draw. When I decided to make the Snapchat thing work, I thought, well, if I want to tell a good story, and I think this is a great platform that's emerging, a lot of it has to do with doodling and creativity. I need to learn. I literally Googled how to draw dinosaurs, and then how do I do angry eyes, and then I'd put them on my dinosaur. I never copied anything, but I would teach myself how to draw by looking up art on the internet, and then I slowly learned how to layer things. Give me a Snapchat, and I'll make you a funny little doodle, but give me a pen and paper or a paintbrush, and I probably can't do much for you. He reached out to a talented Snapchat artist, Michael Platko, who was getting a lot of engagement, and with the aim of mutually growing each one's fan base, they created the first Snapchat collaboration, a boxing match. Each invited his fans to send his opponent punches in the form of snaps doodled with a colorful kapow or two with fists and boxing gloves. The person who received the most punches would be KO'd. Within an hour, thousands of punches were thrown, and Shonduras and M. Platko responded to each round with selfies doodled to make themselves look pummeled to a pulp. They finally declared the fight a draw, but regardless, Sean had won by multiplying his audience by thousands, making it possible for him to move forward with the next stage of his plan. Goal number two was to get press. The major hindrance to growing a brand on Snapchat was its impermanence. There was no way to link, no way to share, and the content vaporized after 24 hours. The only way Snapchatters could give their content a longer lifespan and establish a permanent online presence was to screenshot the images and push them onto Twitter and Instagram. The other way, it occurred to Sean, was to get someone to write about him. Snapchat didn't even have a website, so the only way someone could learn more about the platform was through Google. Shonduras intended to be the first name to pop up. Once again, he got creative. His mother, understandably proud of her son, had contacted a media outlet and suggested they feature his work. Concerned that journalists wouldn't pay attention to a self-promoter, he decided to use his mom's email address to pitch stories about Snapchat. Every night, he'd ask his assistant in the Philippines to draft personalized emails to contacts at the tech trades, Mashable, BuzzFeed, and Business Insider, for example, with an attachment of his work. The emails were written in his mother's voice. I saw your recent article about YouTube, and I thought a story on this new platform called Snapchat might be a good fit for your audience. My son does these really interesting stories there. In the morning, he'd wake up to three or four emails from people asking his mom for Sean's number. The media attention snowballed until he started getting featured in Time, Forbes, and Fast Company. That kept him relevant and top of mind, so when brands started wondering how they could use the platform, as predicted, his was the first name they thought of. While all this was happening, Sean had also been working on goal number three, to tell a story for a brand. Every brand I've spoken to They aren't just a product. They have a story, and they want to share it. All along, he'd been hitting up small brands and local businesses to see if they would give him a chance to create some work for them as a case study that he could then use as a marketing tool. No one was interested until he wrote to Disney. Unbelievably, Disney, the biggest brand of all, said yes. Their branding slogan that year was, "Show your Disney side." So Sean's idea was to go to every part of Disneyland to look for his Disney side, snapping and doodling as he went along. Was he more of a Toon guy, a Tomorrowland guy, or an Adventureland guy? In the end, he was an everything guy, snapping a photo of himself sporting doodled Tarzan dreads, a robot arm, Tinkerbell on his shoulder, and a Captain Hook wig. From there, the branding work took off. Besides reprising his role as brand ambassador several times for Disney, Sean has created Snapchat content for Red Bull, Xfinity Mobile, Taco Bell, and many other companies. He even got to help promote the 2015 release of Star Wars: The Force Awakens. Even at the height of his success, though, he was looking ahead to see what else he could do. That's the thing. Once you've crushed something, you've got to keep moving on. Who knows how long Snapchat's going to be around? Let's crush it again. While still going strong on Snapchat, Sean started developing his YouTube channel. Originally, he was documenting the scene behind the scenes of his crazy Snapchat adventures and travels, but as he started creating more branded YouTube videos and his life became increasingly packed with meetings, the channel increasingly featured all the characters in his life, from the employees working in the space station, Sean's studio and office, to his wife, Jenny, and his baby girl, Adley. In late 2016, they launched a second YouTube channel on which they all have free rein to bring their weird ideas to life. Sean envisions it as a sitcom in which all of his friends and family play a distinct role. His hope is that his audience will get addicted to the personalities and storylines, just as they once did with shows like Seinfeld. Though his YouTube brand deals today outnumber those he does for Snapchat, his Snapchat following remains robust. In addition, he continues to accept speaking engagements, including a TED Talk. He is also working as a consultant helping brands to strategize, work with influencers, and put together strong social media campaigns. In 2017, he announced that he'll be creating branded content for Viacom, including Nickelodeon and MTV. And he recently launched a successful esports organization with some of the number one teams in the world. There's no sign of stopping. Every day, this long-haired skater dude with the instincts of a hardened businessman commits to spreading positive messages and giving people a reason to laugh and have fun. What's the secret to his success? Personal relationships. I think a lot of people establish fake one-way relationships. They just want to ask for something, or they want to do a collab or get a shout out. They don't develop those real relationships and provide value and just give, give, give. If you do that, eventually you'll get back, and that's where the success comes. I have watched this man execute relentlessly for the last 5 years or so. What I love most about him is how his happiness comes through in everything that he does. He's a classic storyteller who isn't afraid to try anything. While many people find every reason in the world to say no, Sean says yes. That's his secret sauce.
10. Twitter. If the following information sounds a little familiar, as though you might have read it before and crush it, that's because you did. The strategy for building a brand on Twitter has changed little in 9 years. But most people still haven't learned how to do it correctly and effectively. Twitter is the water cooler of society, that place where everyone goes to get the latest update on whatever news or pop culture event is occurring. The only difference is that while office workers used to have to wait until the day after an event to gather around and share their knowledge and opinions, now that conversation is happening in real time, 24/7. At the time of this recording, Twitter, in this one man's opinion, is in a really tricky spot. It continues to remain the only pure social network, a place where people interact with content, with each other, and with events in the way that doesn't happen anywhere else. other platforms started out as social networks, to be sure, but eventually became content management systems. There is engagement, but on a far smaller scale than on Twitter. On Twitter, in an instant, you can dive into any conversation about any topic: cooking, outer space, wine, sneakers, politics, skateboards, seltzer. Done wisely, the engagement will compel people to seek out your content elsewhere. Unfortunately, this ease of interaction led Twitter to develop more into a conversation platform than a consumption platform. People talk a lot on Twitter, and the sheer volume is problematic. You're going to consume a lot more of what I say if you hear me speak at a keynote than if you're having a conversation with me. Because when we talk, especially in a group, we'll probably interrupt each other, talk over each other, and get distracted by what else is going on in the room. It's difficult for consumers to absorb everything you want them to when you're talking to them on Twitter. The constant chatter and massive volume has been great for the spread of ideas, which is good for influencers and media outlets. But the chat glut has also made it harder for people to break out as Twitter personalities. Twitter 101. Twitter is disproportionately the place to listen, react, and hijack. Problem is, most people aren't very good listeners. And it's often an especially big challenge for the types of people who want to build personal brands so the world will listen to them. But listening well is the key to engaging well on Twitter. It's by listening that you can find the conversation threads that can lead you to the people passionate about the subject around which you're going to grow your influence. If you're a lawyer who wants to be the next influential sportscaster, it's likely you're going to put out amazing sports-related commentary on YouTube and create a sports podcast. Getting anyone to give you even a passing glance on those platforms, however, will depend almost exclusively on the quality of your content, and even then, a huge number of people just won't see it. But on Twitter, a rising sportscaster could make it her mission to find all the people, every single one of them, talking about Colton Wong, Adam Wainwright, the Cardinals, or the Cardinals' arch-rivals, the Chicago Cubs, or Wrigley Field, and reply in some unthreatening, interesting way that creates a connection between her and each sports fan. The next day, she could do the very same thing for people talking about the Jets and all the Jets-related topics. By the way, going off script here, that's New York, not Winnipeg. If she does it well and frequently enough, eventually she can virtually grab these people by the shoulder and point them straight toward her website, YouTube channel, or podcast. The thing is, it will take a shitload of discipline and patience. Let me define discipline. It's backing up your ambitions with your actions. This rookie will need to spend 4, 5, even 6 hours a day on this kind of engagement, often into the pre-dawn hours, if she wants to become the next Linda Cohn. If she just wants a little name recognition from her town's bar regulars when they talk about their local sports team, then 20 or 40 minutes a day will be perfectly adequate. Maybe. Now, keeping people's attention and nabbing a subscription or a loyal fan will still rely entirely on the quality of what those consumers find on our rookie sportscaster's website. But the point is that Twitter gives you a chance to both lure and lasso, or jab and right hook, people into your orbit in a way that no other platform does. It's a slow process, and it's an immense amount of work. But if you're willing to do it and your content is special, you should see a payoff. Twitter 201. BizDev. Everyone knows that Twitter is still the number one place to get my attention because, to this day, I'm still consuming what people are saying about me there more than every other platform combined. That's true for many other people in different fields. Because it was built to be a conversation platform, Twitter is an interesting place to jumpstart business development opportunities or collaborations as you grow your brand. Maybe even the best place. For example, some influencers have hundreds of thousands, even millions of followers on Instagram, but only a few thousand on Twitter. Where do you think they get the most requests for favors or collabs? So even though they probably spend more time on Instagram, you're more likely to have a better chance of getting a response if you DM them on Twitter, where there's less competition for their attention. There are several other advantages to using Twitter as your pillar content. A. It's a complete and trustworthy directory. The platform has been around long enough to have perfected its verification system, which gives it a better search function. You can still spend lots of time guessing whether the Instagram account you're targeting is real or fake. B. Its retweet feature offers a remarkable opportunity to create instant awareness. Let's say you make a YouTube mashup of the rapper Logic's music videos. It's unlikely he's going to see it, even if he gets tagged. Share the mashup on Twitter, however, and the retweets can propel your video to dramatic virality, the kind that even the biggest influencers notice. This kind of word of mouth does not exist on Instagram or Snapchat, and is enormously beneficial for content creators. C. Not only that, you can try to spark that word of mouth many, many more times on Twitter than any other platform. I post 3, maybe 4 times a day on Instagram, but there are days where I could post 40, 50 times on Twitter. The fact that it's as welcoming to the written word as it is to pictures gives content creators the flexibility and the leeway to increase the volume of their storytelling. On Twitter, you are always just one comment away from getting noticed and making a name for yourself. So the more times you get a chance to talk, the better. Remember, though, the best dinner guests are not just great storytellers, but also great listeners. So bring all your smarts, your wit, your cleverness to the party. Keep the conversation going by engaging everyone around you, and watch your influence grow and your opportunities multiply. There's no other platform that gives you this opening to introduce yourself to so many people so often. Don't ignore it. Imagine this. Let's just say you're a 22-year-old college student named Anna, and your dream is to be a sports commentator. I know there are a lot of you out there, because I pretty much get an email every month asking me for an internship at ESPN or Bleacher Report, Barstool. You know what that means? That means that even the kids who have spent most of their lives steeped in social media and can hardly remember a time before Twitter are still looking at the world through a very narrow lens and completely missing the big career and personal branding opportunity right in front of them. The wonderful thing about sports is that they're the great equalizer. Any basketball fan can walk up to any group of 20 people they don't know and start debating LeBron versus Jordan within minutes and be part of the mix. For many people, they're the easiest icebreaker. Sports also help people ease into new relationships, offering a way to connect with strangers without having to rely on other social identifiers, like your job, neighborhood, or school. Twitter was built for these kinds of conversations. In fact, there's no better place than Twitter for sports personalities and enthusiasts, because there is literally no limit to the number of kinds of sports conversations in which you could engage. Now think about this. Who do you think has a better chance of getting an internship with ESPN? A, the unknown kid who sends her resume in along with 4,000 other people applying for the same job and has nothing but a prayer that the director of the internship program will bother to look at her portfolio. Or B, the kid who becomes a regular, active presence in the Twitter feeds of all the ESPN personalities and staff who actually rely on internship help. The thing that differentiates sportscasters from one another is their greater or lesser ability to synthesize data. Of course, but also the particular ways they add their 2 or 3 or 9 cents to the event at hand. Whether it's the McGregor versus Mayweather fight, or the Cavs versus the Warriors, or the Wimbledon tennis finals, Twitter is unmatched in its ability to help you amplify your voice and your brand. If you're looking for a job or hoping to make your mark in an industry, Consider your activity there as the longest interview of your life, and that's a good thing. There are few feelings more frustrating than leaving an interview wishing you could have said one more thing or showing off or emphasizing the value you could give to the organization. You never have that feeling with Twitter. The forum gives you endless opportunities to prove why you're special or deserve to be respected. So use Twitter to show the world, and in particular, all the important people at various sports outlets who might need interns, your unique perspective and personality. Start by looking at trending topics. In the mobile app, you'll see them listed when you click the search symbol. There is bound to be something sports-related there. Click on it and then start expressing your thoughts. You can do this in two ways. You could just start writing. With a 280-character limit, it could take you 11 tweets to say everything you want to, but that's okay. Or you could try recording a video of yourself talking about the topic. The current video time limit on Twitter is 140 seconds. Then posting that. Include the relevant hashtags so that everyone else searching for the information on that topic will see your tweets. Once you've exhausted yourself with the trends, start searching other sports topics and inserting yourself into the conversations happening around them by replying to people's tweets. You show that you're well-rounded by sharing your thoughts all day, every day, via text and video on everything from the NHL to MMA, the PGA, and World Taekwondo, which was known as the WTF until June 2017 when it rebranded by dropping the word Federation from its name. You reply to famous people. You create content in response to well-known sports writers, personalities, coaches, and athletes. You give yourself every possible opportunity to be discovered as people hit those hashtags and watch those conversations. Done right, this should take 4 to 6 hours. That's one day. On day two, you do it again for 4 to 6 hours, or as many as you can spare when you're not at work or at school. Remember, 11 minutes is 11 more minutes than zero, but also remember, 12 minutes gives you more at-bats to win than 11. Day 3 is Saturday. Awesome. It's your day off. That means you can spend 10 to 17 hours seeking out sports-related topics and engaging with others interested in them too. Day 4, Sunday, the day of rest. You sleep in an extra hour. So you get only 10 to 16 hours of work, but you make them count. Day 5, Monday, go to work, go to school, tweet during any downtime, such as lunch or walking in between classes, meet your parents for dinner, put the phone away, go home, study for your upcoming test if you must, but tweet until 2 a.m. Do this repeatedly, consistently, constantly, until your thumbs are calloused and your eyes are bleeding, or at least until you feel they should be. One of those tweets, maybe within those 5 days, but probably more likely a year down the line, will be the piece of content that catches the eye of someone at a sports station in Kansas City, or Montreal, or Chicago, who will reach out to you to find out where you're working, or whether you'd be interested in joining their team. Or maybe a news station will contact you and ask you to comment for an article. Guys, news stations really monitor Twitter very closely for material. That is absolutely true. One piece of content in a Twitter environment can be worth 100 on any other platform. It's disproportionately impactful. I want to make something very clear. This book, like 99% of my content, is for people who aren't 100% happy. For those who complain, or those who wish or wonder or think what if. I talk about working 12, 14, or 17 hours a day because that's what it took most of today's success stories and entrepreneurial role models to get to where they are. I don't actually recommend unhealthy lifestyles, like getting too little sleep or isolating yourself from your family. But to all the critics who say entrepreneurs like you and me don't have work-life balance or are shortchanging our health, I ask you this. Has it ever occurred to you that the people you're insisting should get 8 hours of sleep are so unhappy with the 16 hours they're awake, that they're willing to invest this many hours to change their lives for the better? What would you rather have? a long night's sleep and 16 hours of misery every day, or a little less sleep but 20 hours of wide awake joy. I'll pick joy every time, and so will most people who are crushing it.
How I'm crushing it. Jared Polin, Fro Knows Photo. YouTube, Fro Knows Photo. Jared Polin's father had a great way of explaining why he always wanted to be his own boss. I'm not going to be told when I can take a leak. A children's clothing salesman, he was known for his honesty. When Jared decided to go into business for himself, he vowed that honesty would be one of his calling cards too, along with his hair pick. Jared uses a hair pick as a business card because he has a seriously big afro and because he is the founder of Fro Knows Photo, a YouTube channel dedicated to fun and informative videos about everything you'd want to know about photography, from proper lighting techniques to choosing the best gear. He spent his youth working in a camera store, started shooting professionally at the age of 15, and spent 10 years touring with bands. This is not someone who ever had to think hard to identify his passion. For years, he had a beautiful website that featured his best work, but he hadn't seen much business come of it. He was 29 years old. His mother had passed away unexpectedly of cancer, and he'd stayed home to help his father take care of his centenarian grandmother. He was shooting weddings, the usual gigs photographers do to make their living, and earning $20,000, maybe $30,000 a year. At the time, most people were saying that blogs were the way to build an audience, but he didn't consider himself a writer. Yet he'd watch other photographers' YouTube channels and be consistently unimpressed with the information they were putting out. Rather than criticize and tell them what they were doing wrong in their comment sections, he simply decided to do it better. He'd attended an event, bartering his photography skills for a ticket, where he had heard this loud wine salesman talk about how he had used video to grow his family's liquor store. This guy was very real and not trying to sell anything, even though he'd just written a book, and he said, "There's no secret to being successful on the internet. You need to be good at what you do, you need to be passionate about it, and go crush it." That resonated with me. It was like a weight lifted off my shoulders because someone else was saying what I was thinking. I had tried some things in the past to make a couple of videos and put them out, but for whatever reason, my head wasn't in it. I just wasn't ready, I guess, at the time. And reading the book, something clicked, and I thought, now I'm ready to do this. He did this in the wine world. There's no reason why I can't go out there and exploit it in the photo world. The original purpose of the videos Jared made was to help him book more photo gigs. Instead, people started coming to him for advice about how to buy camera equipment. Previously, he'd always considered anyone else taking pictures as the competition. The last thing he'd considered doing was helping them so they could compete for the jobs he wanted. Now he did a 180 and decided he was going to give all his information away for free. Because you know what? People don't have what I have. There was another motivation as well. His mother's death lay heavily on him. For years, she had asked her son to teach her how to better use a camera, but time had gotten away from them until they didn't have any left. It's one of the biggest regrets of my life. She wanted to learn photography. There's no reason I shouldn't have taken the time to do this. Other people need to benefit from the knowledge that I have so they can be successful and continue on. He maxed out a $15,000 credit card with an 18-month period of 0% financing, which he suspects was meant for his father, but had his name on it. He bought camera equipment and merch, then started putting out content. I found the thing that I could do, and I beat the shit out of it. I locked myself away for 2 years. Every day, day in and day out, I shot a video every single day. Wake up in the morning, come up with an idea, shoot a video, edit it, have lunch, come back, put it out into the world, have dinner, then stay up until 1 or 2 in the morning replying to comments. I didn't use teleprompters or anything. If I made a mistake, I would make fun of myself and keep going, partly because I didn't know how to edit video. All I knew how to do was put a beginning and an end on it. Sometimes good enough is good enough. Within 6 months, he saw a rise in viewership, 100 views, then 200. All along, he was commenting, answering questions, and interacting with viewers. He made himself available to anyone who wanted to talk. Crush It talks about building your business off of search.twitter.com. I also made it a point to answer every single email that came in. I put up my Skype number so that anybody could call at any hour. If I was sitting there, I would take the call. Then I would get the caller's permission to record the call because there's nothing like free content. They were asking me questions, and if they're asking it, then other people probably have the same one. He made some connections to appear on other people's YouTube channels. As the number of viewers started to climb, so did the number of subscribers. In short order, Nikon and Canon and other photography brands started asking him to review gear. Sometimes they even offered to pay him to do it. I'm very upfront. Someone might pay me, but they can't tell me what to say. If there's going to be something bad about a product, I'm telling you what's bad, whether they're paying me or not. It's all about building credibility. The free model works so well that in the end, he didn't need to take other people's photography jobs. Now he barters trades with bands and musicians he wants to cover. They give him access, and he gets more content to share with the world. In 7 years, he's put out 2,400 videos, all dedicated to helping other people become better photographers, and received 100 million views on YouTube. At the end of the first 2 years, he generated about $80,000 in revenue. Today, he says, he can generate seven figures. You're not going to be successful unless you put the work in. If anybody tells you otherwise, they're full of shit. It's all of the perseverance and all the hard work you put in the decades leading up to it that make you ready. Are you passionate about what you're doing? Are you good at what you're doing? Then fucking do it. It's one thing to read the book. It's another thing to take action. I've watched Jared carefully for years, and what stands out to me is his inability to complain. Like me, he put out hundreds of hours of content while receiving little traction up front, but that didn't stop him. That's the difference between him and almost everyone else, including most of the people who will read this book. He didn't give up too early. Persistence is everything.
11. YouTube. YouTube makes me so happy. It's here that I believe I could possibly help change a life faster than anywhere else. Since 2009, millions of people have quit their jobs and started making a living on this platform. It's the whole reason Crush It and this book and the books in between and everything else in my professional world came to be. Ironically, YouTube is also where I made one of my biggest mistakes in my career. I was a breakout hit on YouTube in 2006, but by the time I started writing Crush It, I had decided that Vidler, its competitor, had a tagging system and a management team that made it a superior platform for me and my content, which was unusually long in 2007 standards. In addition, I'll admit that I was swayed by the short-term economic decision. The company gave me substantial equity in the business. I was certain that my advocacy and ability to put the platform into context for everyone would ensure its rise to prominence. But I was wrong. But you know what? It didn't matter. Because in the end, whether I was talking Vidler, YouTube, or Google Videos, my advice on how to crush it in video would have been 100% the same. I suspect YouTube has created more wealth and more opportunities in the Crush It model than any other platform to date. It's certainly the most important platform for building a personal brand, though Instagram is closing the gap quickly. It could take the place of television. Increasing numbers of people are streaming YouTube onto their TV screens, and during primetime hours on an average day in the United States, more 18 to 49-year-olds visit YouTube than any TV network, even on mobile alone. That's tough news. I know that not everybody who's listening to this book is cut out for video, which is why I'm so thankful that other alternatives exist to beautifully showcase the written word, still images, and audio. However, let's be real. With perhaps the most notable exception being J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter series, and a handful of other writers, in general, over the last 30 years, video stars have financially outperformed stars in every other medium. YouTube 101. Please, even if you don't think your video material, give the platform a try. So many people don't think of themselves as camera worthy, but vlogging and documenting doesn't demand that you be glamorous or beautiful or really superficially special at all. Have you looked at what's out there? Aside from the beauty bloggers, the bodybuilders, and rising pop idols, in other words, aside from everyone in the industry where the looks really matter, everyone on YouTube looks pretty damn ordinary. There are vloggers with disfiguring tumors, vloggers with disabilities, vloggers of all ages and shapes. Vlogging is a terrific way to document instead of create, which means literally anyone can do it. You don't need to be accomplished, at least not the way that 99% of you listening to this defined accomplished, to break out on this platform. Because, remember, when you are documenting and not creating, you're allowed to learn as you go. You don't have to be an expert. Yet. You don't have to be successful. Yet. The only thing you have to do is make the road to getting there interesting. Now, interesting is subjective. You know what I find super interesting to watch? Videos about hitting up garage sales. And I'm not the only one. As I record this, a quick search on YouTube shows videos devoted to this topic of garage selling receiving 50, 100, or 150,000 views. Don't ever decide for yourself if a video about you or the things that you like to do won't be compelling to anyone else. Let the market decide. Trust me, it'll be honest with you. Vlogging is a great equalizer, and YouTube is the vlogging mothership. It's the platform where the person no one thought would amount to anything can make it. It's a tool for finding your best angle, and I don't mean camera angle. If you have a lot of interests, if you aren't sure where your greatest skills lie, if you wonder whether you have the kind of charisma and appeal to draw in audiences to YouTube personalities, or if you simply can't decide whether you'd rather be the number one American authority on pajamas or the go-to guru for spinach, pick up your phone and start documenting your day. Put the results up daily as a YouTube vlog. See which posts get the most attention. And double down on whatever it is that's making those posts stick. But you have to put something out to know if you've got the goods. I didn't mull over whether I should start Wine Library TV or debate whether I was good enough to deserve a YouTube audience. The second I thought filming a wine review show was a good idea, I had an employee go to Best Buy to buy a camera, film the first episode, and posted it. The first episode looks and sounds totally different from the ones I created even 4 months later, because I figured out that I could be me. I held back, not because I was worried about the opinion of the world at large, but because I was afraid if I'd really let loose in the beginning, I'd jeopardize all the hard-won relationships the wine store had from longtime customers who were buying $10,000 worth of wine for me every week. If you look at the first episode, I'm almost unrecognizable. Not because I'm over a decade younger and 15 pounds heavier, but because my personality is so subdued. I say very wine expert things like, when I smell this, it reminds me of a classic Clinet or a VCC. And I'm not going to push the Petrus. Then, by episode 11, you can see the wall behind me have a framed black and white photo of Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier battling it out in the 1971 Fight of the Century. That may have been the first piece of real me, the boxing-loving me, that made it onto the show. In episode 40, I start talking about joy and passion and cut to a clip from a televised 2006 NFL draft where I was caught on camera screaming my head off with excitement with my friends and my brother AJ in response to the announcement that the New York Jets had selected DeBrickashaw Ferguson, an offensive tackle from the University of Virginia, over quarterback Matt Leinart. I was starting to reveal other sides of me because, as I said at the end of the episode, you've got to be passionate about other things besides wine. It's right around that time that I started to realize that the world was changing so much that the channel could potentially be much bigger than I'd ever anticipated. and it might be worth risking a few short-term wine losses in exchange for the long-term value of allowing myself to be me. By episode 57, I give a virtual finger to the establishment. Episode 58 gets even more real with the title, I'm Not Pissed, and reveals that I turned down two network opportunities, one in the travel genre, one in the food and wine genre, because I didn't believe that TV was the future. Now remember, this is supposed to be a wine show. My energy is rising, my voice is going faster, and I'm being more direct. And then my confidence really kicks in with comments like, we're the best marketers in the wine business. We don't need to blog to sell wine. I started dropping colorful phrases like bullcrap and taste the goddamn wine, like bright pomegranate seeds into my monologues. By episode 61, when I start asking for people to keep emailing me because my mail was confirming that I was hitting a nerve and getting people excited and interested, my opening is less Masterpiece Theater and more WWE. As you can see, the delivery, quality, and content of Wine Library TV changed over time. I gave the show time to evolve. I gave myself time to get comfortable and relax into the format. I gave myself the time to get to know my audience and listen to what it was saying. It has been pointed out to me that my first video was 10 times better than some people's 100th in terms of quality and content. Maybe, but again, quality is subjective. Some people are successful despite being complete idiots because the public loves to watch them be idiots. For sure, I'm coherent, and you can tell I know my shit. That was definitely a good start. But remember, there is no way I could have known that I'd be good on video at the time. If I had sat on the idea of starting a wine show and worried and second-guessed myself, I could have probably found 100 reasons not to do it. Thank God I didn't stop to do any of that, but went with my gut. YouTube isn't going to make you charismatic and interesting, but it will expose you if you are. It can't do that, however, if you don't put yourself out there. Give yourself a year to adjust and try different approaches and see what kind of response you get. Listen to your audience. Ultimately, it all boils down to this. Don't let perfection be your enemy. Do not be another dreamer who puts up 10 episodes, gets trolled or ignored, gets discouraged, and takes the channel down. For God's sakes, give yourself a fair chance to succeed. Every single thing that has ever happened on television can happen on YouTube. You can break out as a pop star. You can be a filmmaker. You can become Billy Mays, the infomercial pitch man. You want to become a morning TV star? Start a morning TV show on YouTube. You want to be the next Dr. Drew? Start a Q&A show. You want to be the next Rachel Ray? Oprah? Tavis Smiley? Or Chris Hardwick? Then start cooking, mentoring, interviewing, or talking pop culture on YouTube tomorrow. Yes, it will be harder today than it would have been if you started doing this in 2011, when there were a lot of people watching, but not as many creating. But if you're really talented, smart, funny, or creative, you will win. It may take you a few more months or even years than it would have in 2011, but it will happen. Taking the document, don't create approach means you are conceivably going to pour a shitload of boring content into the miasma of boring content already living on YouTube. That's okay. You know why? Because if in the end the rest of the world agrees that your content is boring, you'll know that you're not cut out for this, and you can move on and do something else. Or it might be because you'll get an email from one of the six people who are watching episode 94 of your 200 yarn episodes, who happens to be the CEO of your favorite yarn company, telling you he'd love to work together one day if you're interested. You decide you're never going to become a PBS star. Call him up and work out a deal where you create educational videos for the company's website. They're a big company, so they get 400,000 views per episode, allowing you to build your brand through them. They are also big enough to pay you very well to do something you love. It might be because you discover that even though the general public didn't get caught up in your craft beer vlog, you had more fun doing that than you've ever had in your career as a software developer. So you approach Yuengling about making educational training videos for their staff, and they bring you on board for a high five-figure salary. The pay isn't that different than you earned before, but you go to bed happy every Sunday, excited to get back to work the next day. Did you become a millionaire? No, but only a tiny percent of the people who will try this will. That's irrelevant. The point is to dream big and then make the practical adjustments necessary once you realize where your potential lies. However, you will never, ever know the extent of that potential until you try. I guarantee it's greater than you think. For a couple of years now, the tech-savvy early adopters have been watching YouTube on their television sets. Very soon, everyone's going to be doing it, and the next generation will see no difference between the two. YouTube will be television, television will be YouTube. YouTube is a monster. Yet, Facebook is making plans to add more features that will make it look a lot more like YouTube. With YouTube in possession of a decade of equity as the established video platform, Facebook is going to have to work its ass off to compete. As you're about to hear, it's going to be a hell of a fight. Imagine this. Let's say your name is Sam. You're a 52-year-old insurance salesperson in Alabama. Your twins just headed off to college, leaving you alone with your partner and the two dogs who have been a part of the family since the children were tiny. As excited as you are to start this new chapter in your life, you know it's going to be hard adjusting to a home where there are no longer any kids around to make messes, cause drama, and add sparks and unpredictability to an otherwise staid and calm life. You've been working for the same insurance company for 22 years. You think retirement is probably only about 10 to 15 years away. You've saved steadily and invested wisely. You have little debt, and the house is mostly paid off. Life is fine. Just fine. Then your best friend sends you a video called 6 Minutes for the Next 60 Years of Your Life. Google that. 6 Minutes for the Next 60 Years of Your Life. You realize that you have potentially 30 to 40 more years ahead of you, and you want to be more than just fine. You want them to be great. And with the kids finding their independence, you now have twice the number of hours you once did to make them that way. You start thinking about all the fun hobbies and interests you let drop off as your life became busier and your responsibilities increased. You always loved to dance. Your mom forced you into ballroom dance classes when you were a child. And to your surprise, you not only really enjoyed the rhythms and moves of the salsa, merengue, and swing, but you were damn good at them. The skill served you well on the dating scene. It's how you met your spouse. But you both let the hobby drop as you settled into married life. It's also been 6 years since you set foot into a gym. By now, your knees would probably have buckled after 2 rock steps. But maybe they wouldn't. And if they did, maybe instead of pathetic, that could be funny. Maybe it would be something you and your partner could laugh about together. You make a pitch to your partner. Let's get into shape and start dancing again. And to keep us accountable, let's film the whole process. Your partner sees how excited you are about this, gingerly pinches the roll of fat that has settled around their waist, and agrees. You discover that yes, your YMCA membership card does still work even though you haven't set foot into the place in 6 years. That first day on the treadmill goes pretty well, and you're feeling optimistic. You hit the weights too. It makes for a triumphant first 3-minute video. Unfortunately, your muscles revolt against the unusual physical activity by seizing up on you so badly that you're laid out flat on your back for the next 2 days. You film your next 2 videos from that bed, filling in your 2 fans with information about yourself, your feelings about dance, and why you're embarking on this project. Those 2 fans are your kids, by the way. Whatever. You change your eating habits, you commit to the gym, and you start attending dancing lessons twice a week. Every day you film a vlog post, sharing what you're liking, what you're not, your diet tips, what you learned in class, and anything else you think might be interesting to your viewers. After a month, you have 4 subscribers. You're pretty sure that the 2 new ones are your kids' roommates. Whatever. For 6 months, you and your spouse continue on this journey of self-improvement, and the results are amazing. Between the 2 of you, you've lost 12 pounds, and the share